back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, Elle Ariel, and we can be found on musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. Happy spooktacular October. Hope everyone is doing well this fall, that productivity, motivation, and inspiration is all chugging on all engines as we move towards the last quarter of 2018. I can't believe it myself. So if you are listening to us on one of the streaming platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more, we would love, love, love it if you could give us some stars, give us some feedback, show us some love, just give us a little nudge up in the rankings, because we are all about talking to the movers and shakers in the music biz, and we'd love to get the word out about this podcast, let more people know about how people got their music jobs. What obstacles did they face? What decisions did they make? What advice did they get? What advice and insight do they have to share with us? Also sharing what's going on in the music industry today and where we are headed going forward. So last episode, I had the great pleasure of speaking with Justin Schmidt of Missing Piece Group. He is a music publicist. He is also a music entrepreneur and a musician. So he talks about all those things in his career trajectory, just really interesting, and also about what you put out there in terms of telling a story, just some really, really great insights that he shared. So go on back and listen to that podcast episode if you didn't get a chance to listen already. My next guest is Brad Siegel. Very happy to welcome him. I've been trying to track him down for a while. He is the founder of Fine Tune Music, an incredible music library that has been featured on a ton of shows. He's going to tell us all about his music career trajectory, starting out as a classical pianist, graduating from Juilliard, no less. So just a really fascinating story that you're going to hear. But before we do that, we are going to play one of the tracks from Brad's music library. Here is a track, a tension track called Serpent. Here we go. How'd you get that music job?
I appreciate being here.
Yeah, me too. So tell me about your first memory of music in your household. What was going on in your household?
Well, I grew up with parents who were highly, highly musical, at least as far as their interest. They might not have been musical themselves, but we had in our house two pianos.
Nice.
And so I do remember, even as a little, you know, toddler kid, always going over to the piano and sort of banging. And of course, that was my dad's master plan, you know, have the piano there, let the kid kind of fool around with it.
Yeah.
And then bam, piano lessons. But also, in addition to me just goofing off, my parents were musical, and they had regular get-togethers, whatever they would call it. But my dad sings opera. He's still alive today, and he still sings.
Oh, my God, I love that.
I know, it's crazy. And my mom was a pianist, so they always had, you know, these Friday night get-togethers with a lot of their friends. And I was the, you know, me and my sister were the little kids there, and we'd get up and play, and it was, you know, kind of fun on one hand. On the other hand, it was sort of like, you know, I learned later that it was my dad who, you know, was all planting the seed, because he wanted me to be a classical pianist, which is totally contrary to what most parents, you know, do with kids who say they want to be interested in, or who are interested in music. They, you know, most parents dissuade kids from doing that because it's a pretty difficult life.
Right.
Obviously financially, but also, you know, just stability. So that really, you know, my first memories of music is my parents having these get-togethers and people would play and sing, and then I would get up and do my little, you know, baby classical pieces because I had the, you know, the teachers from the early age. And that was kind of how it started. And then when I showed talent at playing classical piano, mm-hmm. that's when my parents took me more seriously. Hmm. You know, again, they had a master plan that right. I didn't know about.
Right.
And, but I was good at it.
Yeah.
So it was sort of easy.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had piano lessons and I would do, you know, competitions.
Wow.
And so by the time I... So
and you wanted to do this. Like, you did you have a passion for it when you were...
None whatsoever.
Okay.
I really didn't.
Yeah.
In
yeah.
fact, you know, without getting too deep, but that's one of the things that bothers me to this day, where I don't know what I would have liked to have done.
Yeah.
Because my parents pushed me.
Yeah.
Or directed me, kind of, you know, patted me along
yeah.
into the classical piano route.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was good at it, and it was like, I literally didn't have to think.
Yeah.
I could just do it.
Yeah.
So because of that, I did it. So I didn't, you know, I did okay in school, but I knew I was going to be a classical pianist. That's what my parents wanted. So the fun part about it is that I was good at it and it was easy and I had fun. I mean, don't get me wrong. I had fun. It's just that when it got to the point with my parents where it was obvious that this was like a vicarious thing for my dad because he couldn't be a musician.
Hmm.
So he wanted to be a musician. So he kind of wanted me to do it.
Yeah.
But so when I finally realized that, then I started getting a little upset about things like exactly what I said a minute ago. I never had a chance to think about what I yeah. would have wanted to do. I never fantasized about being a fireman, which, you know, again, whatever, a lawyer, a doctor, a teacher, a pet walker, who cares? But I didn't get to. So later in life, of course, as I had kids, when my kids were little, A, I knew I wasn't going to force them to do anything, and B, I used to play the what do you want to be when you grow up, not to hear them say a fireman, an astronaut, you know, not to hear that, but just to get their brains thinking that what are the options?
Hmm. So, I like that.
Yeah,
I
was
like
kind of helped a little bit, I think.
Yeah. So did you feel then you were just kind of on this like one track trajectory to music college and then performing career, that type of thing?
I knew that that was the plan.
Mm-hmm.
The plan was to go to Juilliard.
Okay.
So, but there were a few things that happened along the way, which, you know, my parents didn't really like very much. So I had a neighbor, when I was probably 10, there was a neighbor, he was about 16 or 17, and he was a blues guitarist.
Hmm.
So one day he came over and introduced, you know, we knew each other, but he brought his guitar over and he said, "Hey, I want to teach you the blues." And I was like, "The blues? Awesome." You know, wow.
Yeah.
And so he taught me the blues and we would jam and we would jam and jam and jam. And I realized later, I looked back on that and I realized, did this guy want to jam with me or did he just want to jam? And either way, it didn't matter because I was jamming with a guy who was six, seven years older than me, who was a monster, wickedly good guitar, like blues guitar player. So I got a lot out of that. I got playing the blues, which was something I never, you know, was exposed to because it was only classical music in my world. I also, you know, when you play with other people, it's a whole lot more than just playing by yourself because
yeah.
you have yeah. to listen. And so that was kind of cool. And then studying and practicing and doing competitions. And then here it is, you are in high school. And I remember the, you know, in 10th grade or 11th grade, whatever it was, that kids started talking about what are they going to do in college? Well, I never had to think about that because I just was going to go to music school.
Right.
I mean, I ended up getting into Juilliard, so that was pretty awesome. But if it wasn't there, it could have been any music school and it would have been kind of cool. And so I didn't have to worry about the SAT. I didn't have to worry about my grades, although my grades were, you know, they were fine. But a second thing happened that was kind of cool, which was in, now I had already moved to New York. So I had a roommate who was not a Juilliard student. He was already out in the working world, and he was an IT guy. Hmm. Now, this was in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. So he was an IT guy in the early 80s.
Right.
And all of a sudden, one day, that famous ad for the Macintosh computer in 1984 came out, and he knew about it already, this guy, and he said, "Hey, you've got to get that. If you're interested in modern music, you've got to get that because that's going to be the future of music."
Holy shit.
Holy shit is right.
Wow.
So I went out and I bought it and I you know, had a synthesizer, but I started learning how to sequence and use the computer as that. So
that is so cool.
No, it was really amazing because it was somebody who could care less about what I did, but was just simply just going, "That is the future right there."
Mm-hmm.
And I would have just looked at it and said, "Oh, that's cool, whatever."
Yeah.
So what happened was in the 3 years that I had that while I was still in school, I sort of became proficient at it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I graduated school, Juilliard, I didn't want to be a concert pianist anymore. I've always been interested in rock and in a lot of different styles of music and music for media.
Mm-hmm.
And so here I graduated and I had this skill of sequencing, you know, using the computer.
Yeah, yeah.
I had the skill of working with synthesizers. Then I had this classical music skill where I could play pretty much whatever, anything. And so I didn't want to move back to Los Angeles right after I graduated. And so the predominant industry in New York at that time was jingles.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, I remember I came home for the summer after I graduated, had a great old summer. I knew I was moving back to New York, so it was like I wasn't worried about a job or anything like that. I got back to New York, I picked up, I think it was Ad Age or one of the advertising brag mags.
Yeah.
And I just started looking through it and reading the articles. And anytime there was something that related to music, I'd write down the company name, and 4 out of 5 of them were based out of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just started calling these jingle companies, and this one guy said, "Hey, what are you doing right now?" And I thought, you know, I'm making calls for work. I mean, he goes, "Come on over. Let's meet." So I came over and there was, so I was 23 or 4 or something, 23. I had just graduated and there was another guy exactly my age there. So there was this boss man who was this older guy. He was the king of the jingle in the 60s and 70s. He did the McDonald's and Heineken and State Farm, all these famous commercials he did.
Yeah.
So he was downsizing, actually. He was going from a big, giant office space to a smaller office space with a recording studio set up.
Yeah.
In part of his office.
Mm-hmm.
And why he wanted me there that moment was because, oh, they were moving and he wanted me to help him move his frickin' boxes. So I did. I moved the boxes. I and he offered me a job.
Nice.
The end of that day.
Nice.
And it was a really low paid job. It was like $100 a week.
Wow.
But he said, anytime we do a jingle, he'll put me on the contract.
Nice.
Meaning if it's a union job, there are contracts and you get a little bit of money every time it plays. So we were doing 2 or 3 commercials a week and I was getting about $75 extra per, you know, every time we did a jingle. So I was, you know, in the early 80s, fresh out of school, I was making a few $100 a week. It wasn't surely not enough to survive on, but it was definitely enough to get paid and to learn the business. And and so I had this, you know, so while I had this classical world of performance and competitions and tour, I even did a couple music tours.
Wow.
Yeah, it was kind of neat. But then I had this other experience of being involved in the technology side of things from the beginning. I mean, not the beginning, but that Macintosh computer that came out in 1984, that started the whole digital, mm-hmm. you know, world. Then synthesizers started becoming digital. The Yamaha DX7 and then the Roland D50, those two synths were like these original synths that just changed everything. So when you can, you know, like a player piano concept, you play something on the keyboard and it records it into the computer, and people are like, whoa, what are you doing? And so I got these jobs based on that ability.
That's wild.
Yeah, it was really cool.
Now, did you feel like Juilliard contribute any to this? Was there any sort of support of that new venture or was Juilliard just like, we're just going to fixate on your classical, we're just going to do the tried and true, this is the path that everyone's taken, that kind of thing?
No, Juilliard did nothing other than classical music.
Got it. And that was it, and there was no...
That was then.
Yeah.
So there was only classical music.
Did they have any idea what you were doing on the side?
Oh, yeah. Oh, for sure.
And
I was known as the improviser.
Interesting.
So I had a piano at my apartment, and that's where I did most of my practicing, but on the days of where, you know, there were breaks between classes, they have practice rooms there. And when I would be in the practice rooms, I was always improvising or writing stuff. And I actually wanted to be a songwriter. That was what I always thought. And so what I would do is, you know, I'd have my cassette recorder and, with the sequencer, you know, once those came around, that's like a recorder. But I would make these little, like, snippets. I always called them song ideas. And I had hundreds of them. And the two things I got out of that was, one, I always thought I was going to be a songwriter, but what I was really writing, and it's what I ended up doing as a job, was I was really just writing underscore. Because A, I never went back and finished them as songs, and B, they kind of were these like little self-contained pieces, just a start, a middle, and an end. And so there were times that I'd go back and listen to these cassettes thinking, oh, that would have been a good song, but it's kind of cool as a cue, an underscore cue. Oh, that could have been a good song. You know, and then finally I realized I'm not a songwriter. I, first of all, can't write words for beans. And in a weird way, I was writing these snippets, not even realizing that this was underscore. So Juilliard, by the way, it really was only classical music. Now, in subsequent years, I've you know, I read all the time that they've added Broadway musicals as a genre of study. I think, if I'm not mistaken, they offer jazz now, which they do that, by the way, to compete with Berklee College of Music in Boston.
Yeah,
which of course is, you know, now when Berklee started, they were just a jazz college. So there was Berklee for jazz, Juilliard for classical. Berklee figured out very, you know, early on that, oh, there's a lot more than just jazz. So they have all their different recording and composition and stuff. Juilliard, of course, has composition, but it was always classical genre, not pop or rock or, you know, or underscore for TV.
Right.
So Juilliard was really just for classical music, and that was that.
But that's really interesting that you kind of just went off the reservation, you know, like you were like, nope, I'm gonna, like, not even just like in terms of pop music or rock music, it was like you were going off the grid in terms of the way you were creating music with the computer and everything else.
I definitely put my hours of practice in on the classical music, but my release was writing these, you know, doing music that was ultimately became for TV and film.
So what happened with the jingles, with the ad agency? Like, can you keep going?
So I got a job at this jingle company, and as I mentioned, he was kind of the king of the jingle. He was an older guy. He was reinventing himself, and there was this, you know, me and this other young guy, and he hired me as a player and a sequencer. So mm-hmm. I was hired because I could play anything and I could work the computers. He hired the other guy who could play anything and he could write.
Nice.
And he hired the other guy, and the other guy could sing. I can't sing. And so whenever a job came in, the boss man would sit us down. He would be telling the other guy what the brief was. And I'd listen, of course, and I would write my own demo. So this other kid wrote his demo, I wrote my demo, and sometimes the boss man hired outside writers as well, but mostly it was just this other kid. And every time I would turn in my demo, the boss man would never pick my stuff. He only picked this other guy's. And there were definitely, look, I love what I do. There were times I'd go, oh my gosh, what this other guy did was great. But there were times where I'd be like, why is this boss man picking that one?
Yeah.
Mine is so much better.
Right.
And not just patting myself on the back.
No,
literally, just
yeah.
going, wow.
Yeah.
And finally, after about, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 months of that happening,
mm-hmm.
I asked the boss man for a meeting, and I said, hey, his name was Sid. Hey, Sid, I'm just curious, I get that Shem writes these great, jingles, but I gotta say, I mean, sometimes mine are better. And the guy looked at me and goes, they are. Sometimes they are better. And I said, well, why aren't you picking them? And he said, because I didn't hire you to write. I hired him to write. And it was such a strange, feeling. Like, what are you talking about? Wouldn't you want the best product for what you're selling? And so what that did, though, was it made me realize I'm never going to be a writer for this guy.
Yeah.
So I had been...
So weird.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
It was so weird. It just struck me all wrong. And by the way, I learned something at that was a life lesson. Not that... But at that jingle company, I learned something. I'll tell you in a second. But what that did by hearing the boss man saying, I'm not going to pick your tracks, it made me start to look for other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I learned from this job that was probably one of the most valuable things I learned in terms of like a working career is, so as I mentioned, he hired me as the sequencer in charge of the computer and as a player. And I viewed my job as the sequencer as like my special job.
Mm-hmm.
And I set up the system and I set up all the backup and the storage of all the files where only I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought if I'm the only one who knows how to do this, I've got myself a job. And then one day at about 3:30 a.m., I got a call from somebody who was working the night shift, and he said, man, I've spent a half hour already looking for whatever it was, particular, project that we were working on. And I ended up having to go in and do it. And the lesson I learned, of course, is unless you want to be called at 3:30 a.m., make sure that everybody knows what's where, But what ended up happening was when I realized that boss wasn't going to hire me as a writer, because now I had about a year experience in a jingle company, I reached out to a couple other jingle companies. Again, that's what the primary business was in New York at that time. And I moved from that company to another company, and this other company was so busy that they had 3 studios going 24 hours a day.
Wow, that's
3
crazy.
Studios, 24 hours a day.
Wow.
And everybody was on 9-hour shifts with a 1-hour overlap. And it was so interesting because it kind of messed me up in terms of work life, because what this studio did, because they had 3 studios, probably 10 or 12 people on each shift,
mm-hmm.
going 24 hours a day, and thankfully I had the day shift. So at 12:45, knock, 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 lunch will be served in 15 minutes, 12:55, knock, 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 start wrapping up what you're working on, because lunch break at 1, and then at 1:00 we had to stop, and we got to eat, and then, a half hour, 45 minutes later, we go back and work. And that, all 3 shifts had that.
Oh, wow.
So it was so it was amazing. I mean, mm-hmm. come on, you yeah. know, first of all, because how many times are you working and you're doing something and you think, oh, I'm hungry. And then next thing you know, 4 hours later, more have gone by and you're now famished and like in need of sustenance. And who knows what quality work you've been doing. So it really was amazing to have that experience. I don't have a chef here, so I'm sorry, it's not lunchtime.
No, but that's cool. I like that.
It was so interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's like a little self-care built in.
Yeah.
You know? So you're working on these jingles, and did you feel kind of like at this point you're a well-oiled machine, like you're just churning them out, or...?
I definitely understood work ethic, workflow. I learned, you know, things like start something, finish something, mm-hmm. because how many times have we all started something and say, oh, I'll come back to that, and then you either don't or you do, and it's, you know, you're like, oh, what was I even thinking?
Yeah.
And ultimately, I got kind of tired of living in New York. I'm from Los Angeles, so I had lived there for six or seven years at that point. So I sort of decided I wanted to move back to Los Angeles. And like, you know, most people, when you get a job, you typically get a job at a place. You don't start your own business. And that's pretty good because you learn, you know, you've got to learn how things are done. And I don't want to say learn on another person's dime, but you definitely learn on somebody else's dime.
Yeah.
And then when I moved back to LA, I a combo of my dad had always worked for himself. He's an attorney, but he always had his own practice. And he kind of, you know, when he finally accepted that I wasn't going to be doing classical music anymore, he kind of accepted that I was going to do my own thing. And he was very suggestive, he suggested I work for myself also. So I had 2 years of really great experience from New York working at Jingle, at Jingle companies. And I had a jingle reel, so all the spots that I had worked on, I was able to use for my demo.
Cool.
And I remember so this was in 1988. So CDRs weren't really around yet,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It was all cassettes.
Yeah.
So I made, I went to the library, I looked up ad agencies in Los Angeles, made a list of 100 of them, made 100 packages.
Nice.
Sent them out. And, you know, I think they say, like, if you get a 1% return, I got a 1% return.
Nice.
One person, one company called me, but it was like, they called me, I went in, I met with them, I ended up for over the next 2 years or so, probably doing 20 or 30 jingles for them, jingles and or just, you know, music. Mm-hmm. And from that, I met a guy who was doing these radio infomercials.
Okay.
Radio infomercials. 2-minute spots.
Uh-huh.
That was all a commercial. But it was done as like an infomercial.
Uh-huh.
So like the pet minute or auto safety minute. And,
yeah.
And he'd interview these people in the industry. And then within that, he'd have a little commercial like for Tylenol. That's how he got paid.
Funny.
I know.
Huh.
So I did all these commercials for this guy where I recorded the voice, edited it all. I supplied the music, whether I wrote it originally or it was part of like my little library. And I worked for that guy for 2 years, and it was great. He was one of my best clients. But from that, it led me to music editing, where I started getting jobs as a music editor for big feature films, which it's such a strange job because nobody really thinks about it. But when big feature films are being made, they're, you know, so they do, you know, just like anything, they write it, they cast it, they shoot it, then they edit it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on the big giant features, and I'm talking like the $100 million studio films,
yeah, yeah.
They usually do 3 or 4 test screenings, which makes everybody crazy because, of course, everybody has an opinion. But what they do for music for these test screenings, they don't hire a composer because a composer needs to work to a picture that's not going to change. If you write music to a picture that changes and they snip out a half a second, you can't just snip out a half a second of music.
Yeah, yeah.
So they don't hire composers to work on films until, or TV for that matter, until the picture is locked. Mm-hmm. It's not changing. Mm-hmm. But what they do is they hire music editors. And because this isn't going to be a for sale, you could use any existing music. So if you're working on an action film as a music editor, you could use music from any action movie you want because it's just temporary. It's a temp score.
Interesting. I never knew that existed. That's funny.
And it is so fun. It's creative. For me, it was always, I never felt pressure because you can only do what you could do. Mm-hmm. Where when you're a composer, it's like you're putting yourself out on the line.
Yeah.
And it takes a day or two sometimes to create a small little piece of music and about 5 seconds for a producer to go or a director to go, yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Got mm-hmm. something else.
Right.
And you're like, I just, you know, spent 27 hours doing this. So I got a lot of experience as a music editor creating these temp scores where, again, you're taking existing music, you're editing it to picture. Mm-hmm. So you're scoring the picture. Mm-hmm. It's just with, instead of with original music, it's with existing music. Mm-hmm. So it's really fun.
How did you get this? How did you get this, like, job?
Well, because I had experience with computers. Uh-huh. And I met a guy, I was in a band, and I met this guy, he was a manager of the band, and he, when the band broke up, imagine that, the band broke up, and this manager and I remained friends, and this guy had an artist that he wanted me to work with. Mm-hmm. So I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. So I met her, I met the artist, and you know, she was more of a lyricist singer, mm-hmm. which I am neither. I cannot write lyrics, and I cannot sing, but I love writing. Mm. So he put us together, and he said, come up with 3 or 4 songs. I want to hear what you guys come up with. And at that time, I had a little mini 8-track reel-to-reel quarter-inch, you know, Tascam thing. It was just a cheesy thing. And I had a couple synths and, you know, whatever, basic stuff. I had my, you know, I had the computer and sequencers, but back then, you know, there weren't digital audio workstations.
Right,
you know,
right.
It was like you got to record. So we did. I wrote these 4 songs. We did not record her, by the way, but we wrote the songs. And the guy loved them. Loved them. So he said to me, what do you need to do a record, to do an album? Hmm. And I was, you know, thinking big for me. I was like, how about a 16-track reel-to-reel and a board and some outboard gear, because that's all I knew. And he said, let me think about it. And the next day he called me up and he said, hey, come, I'm picking you up at 2. We're going for a meeting. And I thought, oh, we're going to go to Guitar Center or whatever, and, you know, we're going to get some stuff. Oh boy. And he took me, and it was bizarre. We drove out to like Van Nuys or somewhere, and it was this warehouse, and there was a bunch of people working, and so in the middle there was this little unit sitting there, and we had a meeting with some guy, and he started showing me this digital audio workstation. It wasn't Pro Tools back then. It was a total different system that's still around to this day, but not for music. It turned out to be more of a dialogue editing system called the Wave Frame. And this guy sat me down, and he's like showing me how it works. Now, nowadays with Pro Tools, I mean, that's a pretty common program and hardware in the industry. And track one is track one, and track two is track two, and input one is input one, and input two, you know, output one is output one. It's pretty straightforward. Well, this was in such the early days. He's like, don't ask me why, but track one is really track 64. and it goes from 64 to 72. And then for the next bank, you go to 90, you know, whatever. It was so totally, I was confused anyway, because it's like, wow, digital what?
Yeah.
You know, but the numbers. And but what ended up happening was I ended up using this system for a year. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of a beta tester for them, but I got this year experience of using a digital workstation.
Yeah.
And that was in 1989.
Wow.
So it was Pro Tools they really didn't come out till like 90 or 91. Uh-huh. They had something called Sound Tools that was before that, but it was like a two track, that was it.
Right.
And then the first DigiDesign was a one rack space unit with four tracks, and it was like four digital tracks. It was amazing. But anyway, so I had this experience with that, and then when that album, we recorded 12 songs, didn't really do anything. I went my own way, everybody went their own way, and I bought Pro Tools. Mm-hmm. And how I got, I think the original question was, how did I get into music editing?
Yeah.
Well, with the experience with the WaveFrame and with Pro Tools, that was the what people were using. So I called, you know, I called around, and you know, you call somebody who knows somebody, and next thing I knew, I got connected with a music editor who was looking for an assistant on a film at Warner Brothers.
Oh, that's so crazy! Wow.
And it was like, I literally, it was just like that boss man Sid who called me, you know, I called this guy, he goes, what are you doing right now? And I was like, you know, that beach trip that my tennis, I was going to go play tennis or something, really, like, I'm like, I'm headed out to you right now, what do you think? And so sure enough, we, you know, I went out and I met the guy, and it was insane because it was first of all, it was the best money I had ever made because it was a union job.
Nice.
Super nice. Mm-hmm. I ended up having enough hours to then get health insurance. I mean, it was like, I thought, oh, I made it, you know.
Nice.
I'm making money.
Yeah.
I've got health insurance that's not costing me, you know, what it costs now. And I'm working on these really incredible projects.
Yeah.
And really soon, I think I worked on two films with that guy. And then I said, screw it, I can do this myself. And I started putting out the word, and then I did that. And then one day, I realized, well, I could do this. Meaning do the music for these, you know, I'm my job at that point was to find existing music to score a film prior to the composer to get involved. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, I watch a scene and I think, oh, it needs like a low string or something, and then just a little itty bitty piano thing. And I remember spending hours sometimes trying to find that, when I thought, what the heck, I should just go record the, I, you know, use a sample for the string, record a little piano, and bam. And so one day I was on a film, it was a low budget film, I wouldn't have done it on a big monster film, although I probably should have. But so the guy said, yeah, I'm, you know, he had a, it was like a murder mystery type film, and my job, he wanted a temp score. So my audition for him, he picked two scenes in the movie, and he said, show me a few variations of what you would do. Mm-hmm. So I picked three pieces of music. The first two were existing pieces of music, true temp music, but the third one on both scenes, I wrote.
Nice.
So, and you know, I didn't tell him.
Right.
And so, you know, I played the first one, played the second one, played the third one. Of course, I was like really nervous, like, oh my God, what, you know, first I was worried that he would get mad if he picked what I did. I don't know why, but, and in both cases, and by the way, I gave a true effort on all three. I didn't make the first two,
yeah,
and it's bad.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this, well, look, you know, right. pick me. And so, and in both cases, he said, wow, you know, I like the feel of these both third choices. And so I said, hey, you know, I got to tell you, I did those. Mm-hmm. And it was so awesome because instead of him hiring me to do a temp edit, I was going to get paid adequately. He said, why don't I just pay you and you do the score?
Nice.
So wow, I was like,
great.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that's how I started doing scoring.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So did from there, you just, did you get more clients and that's how you started your own business or?
Well, I started my own business long ago, you know, and I do whatever, music editing, voiceover recording. I even did song demos for people, which was funny because I always thought I was going to be a songwriter, and then I'd be doing these really bad song demos for people because, you know, when you're the hired gun, you do what they say. It's mm-hmm. not you, it's them.
Right.
And so So it was interesting. And I moved into this studio in 1998. So I've been here 20 years. Holy moly. So I moved into this studio in 1998, and the purpose of it was so I could score film. Mm-hmm. But then I met a guy who did TV. So I did a little TV show, and it was a one and done, you know, kind of a thing. And then I had nothing. And then I got a music editing job, and then that would end, and then there'd be nothing. And then I got an indie film, which, you know, is good to do because you get good experience, but there's no money there. And my experience with any indie film that I had ever worked on was I put all the money I got paid and usually more back into the score, because I knew those projects weren't ever going to get released, they weren't ever going to get distributed, they weren't going to play at film festivals. So what do I get out of it? The music. So I made no money on those, but I would have really good sounding music, so according to me. So what ended up happening was I did a couple TV shows, I did some film, I really wasn't known as a TV guy, a film guy, whatever. And then all of a sudden, I got asked in like the early 2000s to do a reality show. And I didn't know what that meant really until I had the meeting. And what it was actually an amazing meeting, because it changed my whole path. I wanted to be a big A-list film composer. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But this TV show, it was a dating show, go figure. And when I met with them, I said, so what's the gig? What do you want? And they said, we want 75 pieces of music in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And by the way, the budget was like a tenth of what it was for film or scripted TV. So I did, you know, I don't want to say no to jobs because, you know, we all need jobs. Mm-hmm. So I came back here to the studio, and I was sitting with one of the assistants, and I was kind of brainstorming like, oh my God, they want 75 pieces of music in 2 weeks. That's not possible. B, the budget is just pathetic. Mm-hmm. So like maybe they should have, that what they offered was probably for like 10 pieces of music. So I sat there and I thought, huh, I have all this music from projects that I've done where I've retained ownership, so yep. Indie film.
Yep.
I have all these demos that I had done that never went, whether it was for a commercial or for a TV audition, a show audition or whatever. So what I did was, me and my assistant and I back then, we frantically organized this music into categories by emotion. So dramatic, tension, action, although that's not a mood, but you know, whatever. Rock, I can't remember what they were, but they were something like that. And I probably had about 200 pieces of music from, like I said, like films that I had done that I kept the ownership, demos that I had done that I kept the ownership. And I called back the production company people and I said, look, you know, there's really, it's pretty unrealistic to have 75 brand new pieces of music in 2 weeks. So, and I said, and by the way, you know, the budget really doesn't call for that. I said, how about I do this? I have it was off the top of my head. I have a library of music that I could let you have access to. And instead of me doing 75 new cues, how about I do 10 cues for the amount of money that you're offering? And you can have access to this other music. And that would be great. How ideal. And they love this idea because in their mind, they got access to 200 pieces of music. I got to do 10 custom pieces that they owned. It was mm-hmm. a work for hire. Mm-hmm. And so they picked like the important scenes, like the theme, like, you know, the certain key moments. And that's sort of, it was like a win-win because I got that job. I satisfied their needs. They were thrilled because they thought they only wanted 75 pieces and they had over 200. And I got to realize that I just started a music library.
Nice. That's so brilliant.
It was a stroke of luck.
Yeah.
And it turned into something that, you know, so then what I started seeing was a lot of people that I knew, you know, who were getting the film and TV jobs, working, you know, 100 hours a week, which that's not bad for a week, but when it's regular, I mean, you know, come on, you can't sustain that.
Mm-hmm.
I also ended up having kids at a certain point, so I didn't want to be gone for 100 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And this music library concept sort of took off because reality TV shows, whether one loves them or hates them, they are all over the place. They have a ton of music. They need a ton of music. There's all kinds of different styles. And so I started building this music library. So I would, you know, and to this day, when I'm at a party, if somebody asks me what I do and I don't really want to have a conversation, I just say I'm a librarian. They're like, what? Really? I really am. I'm a music librarian. I just leave the music word out. And so I haven't scored a film in a while, but I do TV sometimes. I license library music to shows and film, and I supply music to unscripted TV projects. So what's interesting is I can sit there and say, today I think all right, an emotional concern cue.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'm feeling a little aggressive, all right, an action, you know, a bombastic action track. Or it's kind of a bluesy day, let's crank out a blues cue or something. So it's been kind of fun because while I don't have to, it's like writing poetry. You can write whatever you want. So writing for a music library, there's definitely forms and the craft of writing a piece of music for a library, but you can just write whatever you feel like that day.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're done, you know?
Right. So we were talking before the interview about tech and where the music landscape is kind of headed with all these new content platforms, and literally every other day there seems to be another content platform coming out that needs scoring, that needs, you know, music, etc. What's your take on all that? Like, what's your take on all the new platforms? And
well, my take is similar to the concept of what it was like when cable TV first came out.
Mm.
So here's network television, and everybody, when cable came out, and you know how that, there's 400 stations, and people are like, wow, how can I even find anything, let alone keep track of it all? And the concern was, in the TV world, the concern was that budgets were going to go way down because it's a lower budget arena. So you have your primetime network television. I mean, that's like the cream of the crop. That's what everybody wants.
Right.
But that didn't mess things up. It made it better. The money that you make from that might be less, but there's so much more that you get, you know, the more work to go around. So now with the streaming, I mean, I have some issues with things like Spotify and Pandora, because those are different. Those are taking advantage of loopholes kind of things. But places like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, what's happening is, well, let me go back a few years. License fees for music started to decline and go away starting around 2010 to 12. It happened primarily because two companies, and I won't name the companies, but everybody in the business knows who they are, but two companies decided to start giving their music away for free.
Mm-hmm.
Because when it's broadcast on TV, they make royalties. So 9 out of 10 production companies took this music because they didn't have to pay a license fee for it. Those companies won their bet because they forego the license fee up front, but they got all kinds of placements. So what did that do? When I would call a company and say, hey, this is Brad from Fine Tune Music, and I'd like to license you my library, they'd be like, what do you mean license? I mean, we can get music for free now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, well, wait a minute, you know, no, it's not free. Well, yeah, oh, actually, it is for free.
Mm-hmm.
So-and-so and so-and-so are giving it to us for free.
Mm-hmm.
So what first started happening was that was like the end of the license fee.
Mm-hmm.
So there still are license fees out there, and that's, I'm talking about bulk, like for a library.
Yeah.
You know, needle drop, quote unquote, needle drop licenses where there's a film or a TV and there's an individual, like a bar scene, and they want to license a song or,
the sync fees and all that.
Yes, those still happen.
Right.
But fees for libraries went away. So now with streaming, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, etc., even YouTube, because there's no back-end royalties, the companies can't say, well, we're not going to pay you an upfront license fee because you'll make it up on the back end. Mm. Well, that's not happening. So in a weird way, license fees are coming back. Mm. Now, does it balance? Not necessarily, but it's still all being figured out. And of course, with the Music Modernization Act that just passed, that's going to start making its way into the general world, and we're going to start seeing fees come back, I think.
Mm-hmm. That's good. What about, have you done, or do you have any opinion about like video gaming or, VR or AR, sort of these new...
All of those fall into the gaming world of at least from music. And no, I've never done games. Mm-hmm. I know a fair amount of people that do games. Mm-hmm. And just like library music, in the early days of games, it was like 8-bit, cheesy.
Right, Mario Brothers.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. The Casio sound.
Yeah.
These really cheesy, bad music. And that's what production library music was like back in the day. It's like if you said, I want a piece of production music, people would be like, gosh, but it's just so bad quality. But now, no way. I mean, games are huge. And obviously there's huge success, and composers that are writing music for that are also, they're equivalent on the same level as the A-list film composers. I mean, it's not easy. And again, I don't do game music, mm-hmm. but there's a craft to that, because music has to be loopable. And what I hear is very fun for the composers is they get to write one piece, but that one piece has to be done in various ways, because if the gamer goes down that aisle, it's going to be a different sound. If he goes down that aisle, it's a different sound. So these guys are, people are getting these opportunities to really write some kind of creative stuff, and it's at a high level, so mm-hmm. high quality level, not cheesy anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've taken up so much of your time, but just a quick last question. If somebody wants to get into this business of music libraries now, or film composing, TV composing, do you have any like sort of parting words of advice?
Absolutely. So you mentioned two things. So if somebody wants to become a composer for film and TV, mm-hmm. there's really, you could get all the education you want, but there's really just one way to do it. And that's offer to work for a working composer and accept whatever the terms are. Mm-hmm. And what those terms will be at first is zero pay and every minute of your free time. Mm. But that's how you become a film and TV composer. It's sad but true. And I did it. Everybody that I know who has gotten to a certain point has done it. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is, one, you learn.
Yeah.
You learn both the skill, but you will learn the work ethic. Mm-hmm. Because you don't look at your watch at 6:30 and say it's time to go home.
Right.
Because at 6:35, the new edit's going to get to you, and then you're going to have to work for the next 6 hours. So it's not like there's no life.
Yeah.
And that's as far as like film and TV composers. As far as like music library work, personally, I would highly suggest that people don't start their own music library, because it's oversaturated at this point. Mm. There are a million music libraries. You just go online and search,
right, like Audio Jungle.
Exactly. I mean, and that's a whole other level of music library.
Yeah.
But the best way, if one wants to get involved in doing music for libraries, is calling up music libraries and asking if they can send in some examples. And if you have done research to know what that library specializes in or is looking for, and most people who work at libraries are pretty open. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I personally, if somebody emails me, I usually get back unless they're rude. But, you know, but it's, I'll listen to music, and,
yeah.
and if it's good, I mean, I'll give people a chance because we're busy to the point that we regularly need music. So,
cool.
But really, it's just hitting the ground.
Yeah.
Hit the ground and reach out to as many, if it's music libraries, as many music libraries. If you want to do games, call gaming companies or, you know, figure out who, what composers are composing for video games and call them up and offer to take their trash out for them and get them coffee. I mean,
right.
And it doesn't matter how old or young one is.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I get people. I mean, I'm not doing the film music for TV as, or I'm not scoring scripted film and TV as much anymore.
Right.
So if somebody were to call me, I would say, you know, that's not what I do anymore. But, you know, I'm always open to hearing somebody's music because if it's good and it's available, or they're available, you know, that's the way.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much, Brad.
I appreciate it.
Yay. My special thanks to Brad for a great interview on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? If you want to check out his library and all the great shows that he is featured on, if you want to submit your music, go to finetunemusic.com. That's finetunemusic.com. So this ends another happy, wonderful week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? We have a couple of announcements. First off, we are rolling out a new feature. If you are a music intern, if you are just starting out your music career, you're a musician that's still trying to break into the business, if you are transitioning into a music career, we want to hear from you. We want to feature you. Email me at info@musicjobspodcast.com, or you can reach me on the social media handles at Music Jobs Podcast. But yeah, we want to feature you. Tomorrow's leaders of the music biz. So definitely get in touch. I am your host, L. Ariel. You can find me on social media at L-A-R-I-E-L Music. I have a show this Sunday, the 28th. If you are in Los Angeles, I would love, love, love to see you. It is Sunday night, 7:30 p.m. at The Mint in Los Angeles. Again, it would make me so happy to see all y'all there if you are in town. Please do come out, and you can always dress up. I would love to see some costumes out there in the audience. Okay, baby, so everyone have a wonderful week. Take good care. And again, we are going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you give up.